When Witold Pilecki voluntarily entered Auschwitz in 1940, he embarked on perhaps the most courageous mission in human history. This Polish resistance fighter deliberately got himself arrested to gather intelligence about the death camp from within. Over 2.5 years, he built a resistance network, constructed a radio from spare parts, and became the first to alert the world about the Holocaust. Despite his reports being dismissed and his eventual execution by Soviets in 1947, his final words revealed an extraordinary perspective. "I have tried to live my life such that in the hour of my death I would feel joy rather than fear." This paradox sits at the heart of "Everything is Fucked." How can we find meaning and hope in a universe that seems inherently meaningless? Despite unprecedented prosperity, safety, and technological advancement, rates of depression, anxiety, and suicide continue to rise globally. We are materially richer, but spiritually poorer than ever before. The better things get, the more we have to lose, and the more desperately we need hope. This crisis of hope defines our modern condition, where our awareness of how good things are intensifies our fear of losing it all. We exist as nothing more than cosmic dust on a tiny blue speck in an incomprehensibly vast universe. Our lives, achievements, and entire civilization will eventually disappear without a trace. This is the uncomfortable truth we desperately avoid confronting, our cosmic insignificance and the inherent meaninglessness of existence. To shield ourselves from this reality, we frantically construct narratives of importance. Hope becomes our mind's primary project, the fuel that keeps us going. Without hope that the future will improve, we spiritually die. Consider Elliot, a successful executive whose life collapsed after brain surgery removed his ability to feel emotion. Despite intact intelligence, he became unable to make even simple decisions, eventually losing his job and family. This challenges the belief that suppressing emotions improves decisions. Without emotions, our decision-making capacity fails, even when we intellectually know what's right. We have two mental systems, the thinking brain, conscious, rational, and the feeling brain, intuitive, impulsive. Contrary to popular belief, the feeling brain drives our decisions. Emotion is action, the biological system that physically moves our bodies. This explains why we don't do things we know we should. We simply don't feel like it. Self-control problems are emotional, not informational. An emotional Newton might discover three laws. First, for every action, there is an equal and opposite emotional reaction. When someone causes us pain, a moral gap opens, demanding equalization. This drive to equalize is emotion itself. Sadness is feeling powerless after loss. Anger is the desire to equalize through force. Happiness is liberation from pain. Second, our self-worth equals the sum of our emotions over time. When moral gaps persist without equalization, they become our default expectation. If repeatedly harmed without ability to respond, our feeling brain concludes, "I deserve this pain." Third, your identity will stay your identity until a new experience acts against it. Our values are stories explaining emotional reactions. Changing values requires contradictory experiences, which causes pain. There is no growth without discomfort, no becoming someone new without grieving who you used to be. Imagine it's 2 a.m. and you're still awake, bleary-eyed at the TV, the perfect moment of vulnerability. Someone appears, claiming they can solve all your problems. Though skeptical, you listen as they describe feelings of isolation that resonate deeply. This is how religions are born, not just spiritual ones, but ideological and interpersonal ones too. Everyone must have faith in something. Whatever becomes our highest value, our God value, becomes the lens through which we interpret everything else. Spiritual religions command the strongest follower loyalty, as supernatural beliefs can't be disproven. Ideological religions, like capitalism or environmentalism, face more competition, typically lasting only decades. Interpersonal religions, centered on romantic partners or celebrities, represent immature attachments. To shield your religion from criticism, create a self-reinforcing us-versus-them dichotomy that transforms critics into enemies. Creating fear is crucial. Followers need to feel they're holy warriors fighting evil. Nietzsche's declaration, "God is dead," wasn't atheistic gloating, but a warning. He believed humans weren't psychologically equipped to determine their own cosmic significance. He predicted ideological religions would eventually cause unprecedented destruction through conflicts between master morality, valuing strength and merit, and slave morality, valuing sacrifice and equality. Before science, priests controlled society as arbiters of hope. The scientific revolution changed everything, as life visibly improved. People could see progress within their lifetime rather than waiting for an afterlife. This shift introduced concepts of freedom and equality previously non-existent. But unlike supernatural deities, ideologies face constant challenges, offering little psychological stability. True adulthood means breaking free from bargaining and embracing higher principles. Being an adult means recognizing that the most important things, love, respect, trust, can't be negotiated for. Attempting to do so destroys them. Children operate on pleasure-pain, while adolescents navigate social transactions. Adults realize abstract principles are right for their own sake, even when painful. Adult values are unconditional, ends in themselves, not means to other ends. Kant's formula of humanity provides guidance. Act that you use humanity, whether in your own person or in the person of any other, always as an end, never merely as a means. This explains our moral intuitions without relying on imagined futures. In Greek mythology, Pandora's box released all evils into the world, but hope remained at the bottom. Yet what if hope itself is another form of evil? Hope inspired both Pilecki's heroics and Hitler's genocides. Like a surgeon's scalpel, it can both save and take lives. When ideological foundations are shaken, we confront the uncomfortable truth about our existence. True freedom comes not through unlimited choices, but through self-limitation, choosing what you're willing to give up. While fake freedom demands endless variety, real freedom expands through conscious sacrifice. The deepest freedoms emerge from commitments, relationships, mastered skills, and rooted communities. Pain is life's universal constant. Our minds adjust expectations to maintain a steady level of dissatisfaction, making happiness pursuit self-defeating. Without death creating stakes, we would have no way to determine what matters. As AI advances towards surpassing human capabilities, we face a future where our flawed human algorithms may be replaced. Our emotional needs hijack rational thinking. Perceptual biases curve our information processing inward, and our moral compass gets diverted by our need to generate hope through conflict. The ultimate maturity may be embracing a post-hope world, where people are treated as ends rather than means, consciousness isn't sacrificed for religious aims, and reason is valued alongside emotion. This means integrating our thinking and feeling brains while embracing growth-inducing discomfort. The path forward isn't finding better hope, it's transcending our addiction to hope itself. By accepting our cosmic insignificance while still choosing to act with compassion and principle, we find meaning that doesn't depend on imaginary futures, but emerges from how we live right now.